BBC Proms, many of the tone poems, a few rarities, and three of the operas, Der Rosenkavalier, conducted by Robin Ticciati, Salome from Donald Runicles, and Electra from Semyon Bychkov. So as I said, do join Rob 9 o'clock next Sunday morning, and I'll be back at the end of May. I'm James Jolly. Thanks for your company this Sunday morning, and I do hope you've enjoyed my choice of music today. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production today by Neil Miners.
Could you tell us just quickly what a partimento is?
Partimento is a bass.
Do you find it hard to get your children to practice their instrument?
First, it's also amazing when you put chords to it.
Are you bored with the drudgery of learning to play?
Could you show us like a little partimento bass line?
I'm looking for a music education for my 3-year-old. I want him to grow up with the pure joy of music and a lot less of the pain that I went through. In my journey to find the right method, I've discovered a story that changes everything, that blows the lid off the whole accepted history of music. I'm convinced that much of the great classical music we know and love stemmed from a single place, Naples. Educating Isaac with me, Nick Baragwanath, this evening's Sunday feature here on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3 and next, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the writer and broadcaster Jonathan Meads.
Jonathan Meads can remember the moment he first fell in love, not with another person, but with a building. He was 13 on a school trip to Marsh Court in Hampshire, a country house designed by that great architect, Edwin Lutyens. And since then, he spent more than 40 years writing and broadcasting about buildings, from shacks and piggeries to garden cities and skyscrapers. His latest television series on bunkers, brutalism and bloody-mindedness was screened on BBC4 in February, and his memoir, Encyclopedia of Myself, is published next month, and very entertaining it is too. So, Jonathan, a lifetime passion for architecture. When did this really begin? It was a school trip, I think.
It was a school cricket match. Despite having been educated from the age of 4 till then, till the age of 13, in Salisbury Cathedral Close, literally in the shadow of the cathedral, and despite being close to one of the most perfect inventories of domestic architecture in Britain, that's to say the Close itself, which has got one house of every style and they're all absolutely perfect. Despite that, Marsh Court captivated me in a way which no building had thitherto. It's a strange building built out of deep bed chalk called Clunch, which has a luminosity and takes on the colour of the sky. And this was a very bright summer day, bright blue sky, and so there was a bluish quality to the white chalk. And I was a hopeless cricketer. I think I was probably dismissed first ball, and so I got the chance to wander around this building. And as you walked around it, it mutated. The building changed from one building into another. And Lutyens, and he'd done this in other places too, but not to this extent, this mutation seemed to have something absolutely magical about it. It seemed almost hallucinatory.
And you actually live, rather surprisingly perhaps, given what you've just said, in the south of France. But having said that, you live in a rather wonderful building.
Yes, I live in Marseille, in L'Unité d'Habitation by Le Corbusier. It's the building that begat 1,000 buildings, and it is a place of pilgrimage for architects from all over the world. I mean, if you're Catholic, you go to Santiago de Compostela. If you're an architect, you come and look at Le Corbusier's work, which is sculptural as well as being extremely functional. They're wonderful apartments, and there's something mighty about it.
And it's a French singer that we're going to start with, and one who has a certain element of harshness in the story she's telling in this song.
It's Barbara, whose real name was Monique Cerf. Ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous. My greatest love story is you. It's a sad song, and it reflects her rather sad and troubled life. And the only relationship she felt that she could ever satisfactorily achieve was not with another person, but with the crowd, the mob, the audience who came to see her. And the vous of the title, as one realizes at the end of the song, are the people she is singing to. Along the way to that, there are meetings, rendezvous with men who don't turn up, people who walk out on her, and so on. And the only people she can have faith in and trust in is this amorphous mob who she doesn't know personally.
Du plus loin que me reviennent l'ombre de mes amours anciennes, du plus loin du premier rendez-vous, du temps des premières peines, lors j'avais 15 ans à peine, cœur tout blanc et griffes aux genoux. Que ce fut, j'étais précoce, de tendres amours de gosse, ou les morsures d'un amour fou. Du plus loin qu'ils m'en souviennent, si depuis j'ai dit je t'aime, ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous. C'est vrai, je ne fus pas sage et j'ai tourné bien des pages sans les lire blanches et puis rien dessus. C'est vrai, je ne fus pas sage et mes guerriers de passage à peine vus déjà disparus. Mais à travers leur visage, c'était déjà votre image, c'était vous déjà et le cœur nu. Faisais mes bagages et poursuivais mon mirage. Ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous. Sur la longue route qui menait vers vous, sur la longue route j'allais le cœur fou. Le vent de décembre me gelait au cou. Qu'importe décembre si c'était pour vous. Elle fut longue la route, mais je l'ai faite la route, c'est le lac qui menait jusqu'à vous. Et je ne suis pas parjure si ce soir je vous jure que pour vous je l'ai faite à genoux. Il en eût fallu bien d'autres que quelques mauvais apôtres, que l'hiver ou la neige à mon cou, pour que je perde patience et je calme ma violence. Ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous. Mais tant d'hiver et d'automne, de nuit, de jour et personne, vous n'étiez jamais au rendez-vous. Et de vous perdre en courage, soudain me prenait la rage. Mon Dieu, que j'avais besoin de vous. Que le diable vous emporte, d'autres m'ont ouvert la porte. Heureuse, je m'en allais loin de vous. Oui, je vous fus infidèle, mais vous revenez quand même. Ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous. J'ai pleuré mes larmes, mais qu'il me fût doux. Oh, qu'il me fût doux ce premier sourire de vous. Et pour une larme qui venait de vous, j'ai pleuré d'amour. Vous souvenez-vous, ce fut un soir en septembre, vous étiez venu m'attendre. Ici même, vous en souvenez-vous, à vous regarder sourire, à vous aimer sans rien dire, c'est là que j'ai compris tout à coup. J'avais fini mon voyage et j'ai posé mes bagages, vous étiez venu au rendez-vous. je tenais à vous le dire. Ce soir, je vous remercie de vous. Qu'importe qu'on peut en dire, je suis venue pour vous dire ma plus belle histoire d'amour, c'est vous.
Ma plus belle histoire d'amour. Curious how voices that belong to people, as with Barbara there, that have had some sort of tragedy in their life, one thinks of Billie Holiday, one thinks of Piaf perhaps, how it infects the quality of the voice, or some rather difficult
yes,
to describe.
Yes, it's like Buffon's thing, the style is the man himself, or the style is the woman herself, and it's inseparable from, it's like a vocal tattoo. I mean, I think maybe you have to have something awful happen to you to be able to sing with that sort of passion. I think it's a terrible cliche, you have to have something awful happen to you to be able to paint or write, but that is a rather different thing because your body is not your instrument in those instances.
We're going to move from French song to something which is quintessentially English. And I think this probably takes you back to your time when you were living in a thatched cottage in Salisbury.
It's Britton and Piers, Foggy Foggy Dew, and it takes me back to a particular room in a small thatched cottage, and a room which was crowded with a huge radiogram which was about 4 feet long and like a vast cabin chest.
So this is the music your father was playing you in the cottage. Benjamin Britten at the piano and Peter Pears singing The Foggy, Foggy Dew.
When I was a bachelor, I lived all alone and worked at the weaver's trade. And the only thing that I ever did wrong was to woo a fair young maid. I wooed her in the winter time and in the summer too. And the only thing I did that was wrong was to keep her from the foggy, foggy. One night she came to my bedside when I lay fast asleep. She laid her head upon my bed and she began to weep. She sighed, she cried, she damn near died. She said, what shall I do? So I hauled her into bed and I covered up her head just to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew. Oh, I am a bachelor, I live with my son and we work at the weaver's trade. And every single time that I look into his eyes, he reminds me of the fair young maid. He reminds me of the winter time and of the summer too. And of the many, many times that I held her in my arms just to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew.
Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears with Britten's arrangement of The Foggy, Foggy Dew. Peter Pears' uncle disapproved of that song because he thought it was immoral and rather naughty.
It is terribly discreet. Yes, but one gets what's going on, even at a very tender age.
You didn't terribly enjoy your time in that thatched cottage, did you?
No, it was unbelievably cramped. My parents rented it for 6 months in just after they married in the summer of 1939, and they eventually stayed there, still renting it, for 23 years, whereupon they made their only move of their life to a house 400 yards away beside the river. My father had refused to move until he could find somewhere to beside the river.
Of course, those thatched houses have a tendency to burn down, don't they?
Especially if my mother was living in one. She was a very accomplished chip pan incendiarist, and she taught at a primary school. During the holidays, she had put on chip fat for lunch and then popped down to the Rose and Crown for a quick one and forget about it. And I came back on several occasions and found the place about to go up.
Do you think that you might, Jonathan Meads, get from your mother an element of your own naughtiness, your slightly maverick streak, because you like to provoke people?
I like to tell the truth. I don't set out to be contrarian. I get described thus.
No, but in embracing the truth in a very wholehearted way, some people sometimes...
I prefer truth to courtesy. That's a way of putting it. Yeah, both my parents were like that. Mm. They were not ambitious in a worldly sort of way.
But actually, it's been a quality of your journalism that people really like. Your recent television series had bloody-mindedness in the title. And I think it's always refreshing to feel one's going to get from a pundit of any sort an absolutely straight-from-the-heart description, because we live in a PC world where people are a bit nervous.
Yes, I think 30 or so years ago, my stuff would have not stood out in any way. There were lots of people who said what they thought. I mean, you'd get Muggeridge, you'd get James Cameron, you'd get writers like Peter Nichols. The ethos has changed fairly drastically, but I appear not to have changed particularly. I mean, there is a crippling caution which I fight against, really.
Thanks to biscuits, you got to know Britain rather well when you were young, didn't you?
Yes. My father was a rep for William Crawford's. The area he covered was around 30 to 40 miles around Salisbury, included places like Wimborne, Sherborne, Marlborough, Winchester, just to mention the ones which have famous public schools, but also places like Marchwood on Southampton Water, Lymington, the New Forest, the army camps which dominate the southern part of Salisbury Plain with their unbelievably banal architecture. And I would get to one of these towns and he'd just let me go off and wander around, which obviously nowadays one would not allow a child to do that because one would suspect that the child would be molested or something. But in those days, no one really worried. And I would wander around these towns and just gape. It was an unwitting form of autodidacticism. And I didn't know that Tudor Beethan pubs weren't as noble as Georgian terraces. I just liked looking.
Or cathedrals, of course, you encountered a great deal.
Well, yeah, Salisbury Cathedral, Winchester Cathedral, Sherborne Abbey, Wimborne Minster.
Did you appreciate them for themselves, did you discover that actually you were looking at what you were supposed to consider a great piece of architecture?
I didn't really know that there was a hierarchy of use, and it's something I still dispute. I don't see why a car park can't be as fine as a chapel. In fact, I think many car parks are far, far greater buildings than chapels. But I didn't know this then.
You actually recounted some of these experiences in a television series called Father to the Man. I don't know whether you revealed in that how many biscuits you ate during all of this, or were you turned off by them?
I had no interest in biscuits at all. Absolutely not.
But the music you chose for that series, it's Puccini's Gianneschichi and Maria Callas singing O Mio Bambino Caro.
Thank you.
I wonder whether the characteristics that inform the food of a country, whether there's any connection with them and the kind of quality of music. I mean, one thinks of something like that aria, which is such an effortless olive oil-like melody.
Well, Edgar Morin, ethnologist and novelist, said that the kernel of any nation's culture is in its food. But then he would say that because he's French. It's difficult to apply that to a gastronomically diverse country like Britain, where there again there is no consensus about food.
Well, and for many years there wasn't a great deal of food to talk about, was there?
I think it was better than it's represented. I think the idea that food in Britain was terrible is the present congratulating the present.
But I mean, if you were a visitor to this country and you were going round looking for, there was nothing like what you'd find in France or Italy.
No, oh, absolutely.
And that's got better.
It has got better. And I remember my father taking a French friend to lunch in a Salisbury hotel, and he was served Yorkshire pudding, and he said, "Mon Dieu, c'est du plastique." Yes, it is much better. But the idea that there might be a link between food and music, I think, is quite an attractive idea, actually. Yeah.
Well, we heard O Mio Bambino Caro from Giannis Chicchi, sung by Maria Callas with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Tullio Serafin. Now, when you first began to really get interested in food, Jonathan, I think it probably coincided slightly with when you went as a child to France, didn't it? Because your mother actually cooked, but not à la France.
No, I was very interested in what my mother cooked. She was a very good cook. But then we would go very frequently to Saint-Malo, because my grandfather worked for Southern Railways, which owned the ferries. We got extremely cheap fares, entirely atypical thing for a sort of lower middle class family to do in those years, to go off for long weekends to Saint-Malo and go there on holiday. And I would generally eat with the hotel staff. I remember years later talking to my mother about eating horse, and she said, "Well, of course you did eat it with the hotel staff. That's what they had most days, roast horse," which I enjoyed very much. I didn't know it was horse. But yes, it did open up a whole sort of area of food which wouldn't be replicated in Britain at all, save in Soho.
You spent 15 years, Jonathan Meads, as a restaurant critic. And I think the next music was something you discovered in a restaurant in Genoa.
One of my daughters was teaching in Genoa. And we went to what looked to be a typically Italian restaurant. And this is Fabrizio De André, Canzone del Amore Perduto, the Song of Lost Love. De André is a very interesting figure, a great man of the left. And he sang a lot of shanties. And he also was very interested in a Genovese tradition of something called Tralalero, which they're a squadri of men who sing in the street, precursive of doo-wop or barbershop stuff. This song is of a completely different nature. It's just a rather beautiful, one wouldn't call it mawkish, it's the full mawk.
Tre parole, non ci lasceremo mai, mai e poi mai. Vorrei dirti ora le stesse cose, ma come fa un presto amore ad appassire le rose? Per noi l'amore che strappa i capelli, è perduto ormai, non resta che qualche svogliata carezza e un po' di tenerezza. Quando ti troverai in mano quei fiori appassiti al sole d'un aprile ormai lontano, li rimpiangerai, ma sarà la prima che incontri per strada che tu coprirai d'oro per un bacio mai dato, per un amore nuovo.
Fabrizio De André and Canzone dell'Amore Perduto. Was the food any good in this restaurant?
Yes, it was excellent. Yes, I like Genovese cooking very much. I like Genoa indeed. I mean, one of my favourite architects built a huge amount of stuff there, Gino Copede, who also did the Cartiere Copede in Rome. But in Genoa, he really excelled himself. I mean, he should be as famous as Gaudi or someone like that, but ain't.
You were at RADA for a while, weren't you?
And yeah, I did the whole thing.
The principal said you'd make a fine character actor in due course, but perhaps not until you were 40.
Yes. I thought if I'm going to be resting for 20 years, I'd better do something else, which is what really prompted me to start writing. Mm.
But years later, you met him, didn't you?
Yes, okay. He said, well, I was right, wasn't I? The only thing I was wrong about was the fact that the character was called Jonathan Meads. but I think he perfectly appreciated that what I do on telly is a performance. It's not really anything like me.
So interesting, because I was reading only yesterday some writing of Auden's that has been sort of resurrected. This was in the New York Book Review. And there was a piece where he describes his self-loathing at the way he can manipulate an audience and get them to, as he put it, to roar, but afterwards felt dreadful. Do you ever feel, and not necessarily self-loathing, but an element that you are putting on a performance that is not entirely you?
I'm always putting on a performance that's not entirely me, but I suppose it has become me in some way because...
So when we're talking now, are we getting really a sort of a cross between the private you and the you that comes out in a...
I think it's probably much more the private me. Mm. I mean, the frailty, the feebleness, the self-doubt, and all of those things.
But I like the style you developed in your films. It makes me want to watch, and I enjoy it. And you do feel that you owe a little bit to French filmmakers, don't you?
Yes. I mean, that was a great education, being both in France in the 60s and during the time I was at RADA. I used to go to cinema every day. And film, apart from anything else, gave me what tiny musical education I've had. And this, hence...
Well, it is a soundtrack to one of those classic French films. It's Muriel, a film by Alain René, who died just recently, and which came out in 1963.
Yes, I mean, this score, which I had not heard anything like it before, there was a kind of real grandeur about this and an absolute strangeness. It's a strangeness which I still feel.
It would be fascinating for those people who don't know the film to hear what we were looking at there as well as what we were hearing.
It's the very end of the film, which is a confused and fragmented film, deliberately confused. The editing has none of the mellifluousness and fluidity that René usually used. They're endless cuts and the same thing seen from slightly different angles. And at the end of the film, the protagonist is walking through an empty flat.
A woman.
A woman. One doesn't know what she's up to, whether she's trying to recapture some sentiment that she felt when she was in that apartment previously.
But the interesting thing about that is that where a lot of Hollywood-type music, for example, would tell you what to think...
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Hence there enters into the spirit of letting on.
Yes, entirely. I mean, there's an opacity about both what you're seeing and about his score, which is great. I mean, I don't think things have to have a meaning at all.
The final section of Hans Werner Henze's soundtrack to the à la René film Muriel, with the voice of Rita Streich. Your next piece of music is a Beethoven string quartet, number 13 in B-flat major. Beethoven, I don't think, ever saw it performed in its final form, because it had its premiere almost a month after his death. But you've chosen the fourth movement, a la Danza Tedesca, the German dance. Why particularly this?
It's a ridiculous thing to say, but it's not very Beethovenian. It has a douceur and a kind of gaiety and joy, which is not something I associate with his bombast. Mm. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things ever written. There's no reason other than that I chose it. I mean, I just.
Are you not so keen on a lot of Beethoven?
Symphonic stuff is too big. I like novels which are big and come at you from all directions. Probably like architecture and painting like that too. I prefer music, as is fairly evident, which is fairly discreet and quiet and doesn't have much...
So would you say you prefer chamber music?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. It's rather like oranges and lemons, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't have thought it if you hadn't mentioned it, but now that you do mention it, I can hear it. That was the fourth movement, Alla Danza Tedesca, from Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 130, played by the new Budapest String Quartet. The key to a lot of your work, Jonathan, is finding things like oranges and lemons, if you like, in that piece, finding things in things that you're talking about to praise that other people might not notice, and also things to decry quite often, things like decrepit pumping stations or piles of asbestos sheets, even supermarket trolleys dumped in canals.
I find it it's part of the richness of life and the squalor of life. Mm-hmm. It probably goes back to this idea of being self-tutored, of not knowing that such and such a thing was supposed to be good and such a thing was supposed to be bad. I find it all fairly fascinating. And yes, I mean, I take a lot of photos. I mean, I did a book of a box of photographs recently, which called Pigeon Snaps. And a lot of that is photographs of rusting hawsers or bits of detrited paint on doors. And I find these surfaces are very exciting. And I take lots of photographs through car washes, as one does. And you've got instant abstract expressionism.
Well, you made a series of films talking about this subject, extolling the flat countryside that Jacques Brel sings about in our next song. And in a way, that was another continuation of this theme, wasn't it? What you found beautiful here, which to some people would seem monotonous or flat.
Yes, the flatlands are often portrayed as monotonous, and I suppose in a way you've always got a big sky. But I find that disciplined landscape, man-made landscape everywhere, whether it's the fens in Lincolnshire, Cambridgeshire and Norfolk, or whether it's the flatlands to the west of Bremen, or those which Brel sang about in Holland and Belgium. I mean, he was Belgian. He was unusually, he was bilingual. But his voice in Flemish has a raspingness which I find very appealing.
Wanneer de Noordzee koppig breekt aan hoogduin en witte vlokken schuin uiteenslaan op de kruinen. Wanneer de Norse vloed beugt aan een zwart basalt en over dijk en duin de grijze nevel valt. Wanneer bij Epp het strand woest is als een woestijn en natte westenwinden gieren van venijn. Dan vecht mijn land, mijn vlak land. Wanneer de regen daalt op straten, pleinen, perken, op dak en torenspits van hemelhoge kerken, die in dit vlakke land de enige bergen zijn. Wanneer onder de wolken mensen dwergen zijn, wanneer de dagen gaan in donne regelmaat en bolle oostenwind het land nog vlakker slaat, dan wacht mijn land, mijn vlak land. Wanneer de lage lucht vlak over het water scheert, wanneer de lage lucht ons nederigheid leert, wanneer de lage lucht er grijs als sleisteen is, wanneer de lage lucht er vaal als keilie. Wanneer de noordenwind de vlakte vieren heeft, wanneer de noordenwind onze adem steelt, dan kraakt mijn land, mijn vlak land. Wanneer de Schelde blinkt in de zuidelijke zon en elke Vlaamse vrouw flaneert zon Japon, wanneer de eerste spin zijn lentewebben weeft, of dampende het veld in je
zonlicht beeft wanneer de zuidenwind verschatert door het kraan. Wanneer de zuidenwind er jubelt langs de baan, dan juicht mijn land, mijn vlak land.
It's a very curious soundscape, isn't it?
It's extraordinary.
The flatlands.
And it evokes them in a way that, as I say, I don't think he does in French, even though, you know, he talks about our only mountains are the cathedrals. And it's rather akin to a Brel imitator called Pierre Bachelet, who sings about the slag heaps round Lille and Valenciennes as being mountains. And then they are very, very high.
And there's something about the slightly spluttering gutturalness of the language which actually lends something to the song.
I love that quality. It's something about the harshness of the north, where you get something which it should be picturesque, like very sculpted gables, but in actual fact they're frightening against the sky.
It's an impressionistic list, really, isn't it, of all the elements of that landscape. And list-making, Jonathan Meads, is something you rather enjoy in any language.
I do. It's a tic which I'm going to have to rid myself of sometime, but my writing is full of lists.
Mm-hmm. Is it important for you to continue to find things that actually make you see the world in a different way?
Yes, it is. It's why I travel quite a lot, but I don't travel to particularly touristic places. I think it's impertinent to look for authenticity, but I do look for different things, and I tend to think of how I'm going to write about them, how I'm going to photograph them, because it makes me engage with what might otherwise be an extremely banal experience. But I will go to extremes. I've eaten beaver in Lithuania, udder in Buenos Aires, and something truly foul in Azerbaijani restaurant in Moscow, which tasted like fermented spam. It wasn't. It was terribly expensive. But I have that sort of curiosity, and I like getting lost. I like going to a city I don't know and wandering round.
Having said how much, Jonathan, you like chamber music, you're now going for the full orchestral effect in Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1.
Atypically, it is not a chamber piece at all. I mean, it's a big bruiser, and you can whistle it too.
Although one thinks of Tchaikovsky as having a certain pathos to his music, that has quite a sort of almost a joyous lilt to it as well, doesn't it?
Yes, I don't see pathos in it whatsoever. It's
declamatory.
Yes, grandeur, and it's rhetorical.
Marta Argerich playing Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 with the late Claudio Abbado conducting the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. In your new memoir, Jonathan Meads, you write very memorably about your restlessness and that desperate desire to escape from where you were brought up. And I wonder whether you still feel a desire to be somewhere else, or that you've now found living in the south of France is the right answer for you.
No, I mean, it's always going to be somewhere else. The grass is greener. The chalk track which leads up over the hill will reveal on the escarpment something beyond. It's inescapable. I mean, it's written into me. And I won't stay in Marseille forever.
You once described, rather memorably, I think, buildings as provisional jails. And you've been jailed in this one for quite a while now, so we're probably getting to the moment where we should release you. And what is the piece of music that you'd like to play out on?
It's a Rolling Stones track called Time Waits for No One, and I'm getting old.
Does it frighten you?
No. No, it doesn't. I mean, what does frighten me is impairment, the realisation that my limbs aren't what they were, that my memory isn't quite as sharp. Although my memory is still very, very good, but I've always had a particularly strong memory, and also rather indiscriminate memory, actually, as that book bears witness to. I've always thought of death on a very, very regular basis, like daily. I just realise it's now closer.
Well, Jonathan Meads, in the words of the Rolling Stones, time waits for no one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Rolling Stones with Time Waits for No One, ending this week's edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay was talking to the writer and broadcaster Jonathan Meads. Next week, there's another chance to hear Michael in conversation with the landscape and nature writer Robert McFarlane.
The 18th Century season on Radio 3 explores music written for a superstar. Live from Wigmore Hall in London, mezzo-soprano Anne Hallenberg joins Christophe Rousset and his high-energy ensemble Les Talents Lyriques to recreate the arias written for the castrato Farinelli. If you love Handel, don't miss this opportunity to hear little-known gems by several of the other star composers of Baroque opera who wrote for the most celebrated castrati of the day. Join me, Petroc Trelawney, for Arias for Farinelli, live in concert, tomorrow at 7:30, here on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's just after 1 o'clock and it's time now for the news, read by John Shea.
Two of the most influential popes of the 20th century have been made saints at a ceremony in the Vatican. In front of hundreds of thousands of people in St Peter's Square, John XXIII and John Paul II were canonised by the current Pope Francis. The previous Pope, Benedict, was also at the ceremony. South Korea's president has accepted the resignation of her prime minister following the ferry disaster in the country earlier this month. Chung Hong-won apologised for the government's response to the tragedy and said the cries of the families of those missing kept him awake at night. 188 people are confirmed to have died. More than 100 others are still missing. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said Europe and the United States will press ahead with more sanctions against Russia if Moscow does not de-escalate the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Pro-Russian militants are occupying state buildings in the area, and in Slavyansk, a team of 8 international observers are being held. The head of the task force in charge of eliminating Syria's chemical weapons says Damascus still holds nearly 8% of its arsenal in one particular site. Sigrid Karg said there had been very constructive cooperation and urged Syria to acquit itself of its commitments. The Ministry of Defence says a helicopter crash in Afghanistan in which 5 British servicemen died yesterday appears to have been a tragic accident. An investigation is underway. David Cameron said his heart went out to the family and friends of those killed. The Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas has described the Holocaust as the most heinous crime against humanity in modern history. His comments, made just ahead of Israel's Holocaust Remembrance Day, come after the Israelis suspended peace talks. Mr. Abbas called on the Israeli government to take the chance to find a just and comprehensive peace with the Palestinians. And the weather. Sunshine and showers will continue across many southern and central parts, and there'll be the risk of some hail and thunder. It'll be cloudy across many northeastern areas with outbreaks of rain, but generally drier elsewhere with some sunny spells. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
And it was read by John Shea. Now another chance to hear the Radio 3 lunchtime concert, which was given last Monday at London's Wigmore Hall. It was introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello, welcome to Wigmore Hall. The trio Wanderer brought out an acclaimed recording of the Tchaikovsky Piano Trio last year, which they're playing here live in this lunchtime concert. But first, they're going to play music by the composer who inspired their name. They're called the Trio Wanderer after that German romantic archetype, the solitary man who wanders through nature in search of the sublime. And the composer most associated with that Wanderer figure through his fantasy and also his song cycles was, of course, Schubert. So the trio is starting their recital with Schubert's bewitching single movement Notturno, or Nocturne, for piano trio, which has an extraordinary atmosphere of stillness across its 10 minutes, with a rippling accompaniment to a slowly unfolding melody. Trio Wanderer are the violinist Jean-Marc Philippe Varjabedian, the cellist Raphaël Pidou, and the pianist Vincent Koch. Here they are on stage at Wigmore Hall to play Schubert's Notturno in E-flat.
Thank you.